99%ers, this is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, another interesting week here. What are we going to talk about today? Well, first of all, we got to talk about this Panama Papers revelation. Oh, well, finally we get another peek into the global tax avoidance by the 1% and their corporations and how massive it really is. While the rest of us are struggling to figure out how we make a living on gig and part-time temp jobs and jobs going away and no wage growth and paying more for utilities and insurances and so on. While we're struggling, as we have been for over a decade now, the rest of these rich folks just keep stuffing their trillions of dollars away in these offshore shelters and avoiding paying taxes. I've been talking about this topic for a long time. If you go back to my book, The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Reagan to George W. Bush, published in 2005, I have a lengthy chapter there called The Great American Tax Shift. This was well before some of our neoliberal and even so-called progressive economists discovered the tax role in the growing income inequality. You know, the income inequality is not caused simply because we're not getting wage growth. Yeah, that's part of it. That's part of it. But it's because the folks at the top are having accelerating income, capital income growth. Both of those cause income inequality. The bottom is not growing, at least the middle class, the working class, you know, folks making 90,000 tops, maybe a little bit more if you're in tech, a year, and at the bottom, people, 40, 50 million people in the U.S. who are living on minimum wage or barely minimum wage in poverty. Yeah, you can raise that minimum wage a little bit, and that's good. But what about the great majority of workers and middle-class people in the middle at 50, 60,000? They're going backwards. Yeah, we take care of the very, very bottom a little bit, and then we really take care of the folks at the top. You know, they get everything, as recent studies of IRS data showed. 97% of all the income gains since 2009 have gone to the wealthiest 1%. The whole growth, to what extent there has been any growth, the income created by it has gone to the 1%. And then they wonder, no wonder we can't get wages going. Oh, they talk about all the jobs they're creating, but they're part-time temp gig jobs, independent contract jobs with no benefits. And wages, you know, low wages. No wonder. And to the extent we got consumption going, it's households taking on more and more consumer debt. Going through the roof, once again. And that's how this great economy, economic recovery, has been proceeding now for 8 years. What a recovery. Yeah, recovery for them, no doubt. Doubling and tripling of corporate profits, and as I've written before and talked before, you know, $5 trillion in so far, not counting this year, in stock buyback and dividend payouts just in the U.S., $5 trillion of additional tax cuts since Obama's come into office. That's on top of the $3.5 trillion tax cuts for the rich under Bush. And then they wonder why we got a deficit problem? Well, all you got to do is turn the clock back to where we were taxing the rich before a couple of decades ago. It all starts, of course, under Reagan and accelerates under Bill Clinton and then really accelerates further on the Bush, and Obama's continued it. You know, we hear a lot about this tax inversions. Well, I've been writing about that in my articles for Telesur as well and for Z Magazine. You know, just go to my website, jackrasmus.com, and you can read these articles where I document all this. And the longer articles on my website, Kyklos Productions, kyklosproductions.com. I'm talking, you know, for years about this. This is not revelation. This is new. Oh, revelation in the sense that it hits the business press. So what is this Panama Papers thing? Well, apparently there's this law firm. What's his name? Fonseca and something, I think, in Panama. And this law firm CEO, somehow, it's not all clear what happened, but they spilled the beans. They spilled the beans here. You know, Panama is a major tax shelter for the United States wealthy. They like to put their money in Panama. You know, in 2009, there was a little bit of a flurry because of the crisis about how the rich were stuffing their money offshore and everything, and there was a international effort to try to reveal this, and Obama made a tepid effort to reveal wealthy money stashed in Switzerland, and he put some pressure on Switzerland a little bit, but then he quickly backed off by 2010, and that effort was all over. Yeah. So, some other countries signed on to this effort to share tax data of the rich, to require their banks and shadow banks to reveal some of the tax sheltering going on. But there are two countries in the world that did not sign on to that, and guess who they are? The U.S. and Panama. Yeah, the U.S. says, oh, we want you folks in other countries, you governments, to reveal U.S. Investors stashing their money over there, but we're not going to reveal your wealthy people stashing their money here. And Panama is the same. By the way, you know, let's talk about Panama. We got a little Panama right here in the U.S. It's called Delaware. You know, corporations can set up, and people can put their money in trust and set up a corporation, a shell corporation in Panama, I mean in Delaware, and avoid taxes. So we got our little Panama called Delaware in the United States, and now other states are trying to copy it, like Wyoming and so forth, you know, a couple others, Nevada, I think it is, right? You know, we got our tax shelters within the U.S. In 2009, as I wrote in one of my books, I think it was Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few, where do the mega wealthy rich stuff their money offshore? You know, what are the locations? Well, there was a Senate investigation in the U.S. that led nowhere. I think it was in 2007 or 8, right before the crisis. And the result of those Senate hearings was that there's 27 special jurisdictions around the globe. The IRS calls them special jurisdictions, where the wealthy stuff their money, and the U.S. can't find out who and how much has been stuffed. And there's an IRS rule that if you can't get the data, and once you initiate a case, after 2 years, you've got to drop the case. So these 27 jurisdictions around the world, I'll name some of them here, you know, simply stonewall IRS agents' efforts to find the information. And after 2 years, IRS drops his case. Right? Now, where do they stuff it? Okay, you know, there's been books written about this. This is not revelation, really. In the UK, British capitalists and wealthy, they love Bermuda. You know, that's kind of a British protectorate. You know, Bermuda, an island off the east coast of the U.S., way out there in the Pacific. And reportedly, these Panama Papers have revealed that there's at least $1 trillion stuffed in that little island of Bermuda, most of it British. Well, where else do British like to stuff their money? Well, British Virgin Islands in the Caribbean, and closer to home, the Isle of Man and the Isle of Jersey. You know, these are little islands off the coast of the UK, which have special tax laws, I guess. I don't know why, but they do. So the British like to stuff their money in those areas. And by the way, this Panama Papers thing is just beginning to revelations. You know, they're just beginning to identify who individuals, you know, wealthy individuals and politicians. They're focusing on politicians right now. You may have heard that the new conservative prime minister of Iceland got caught. Yeah, I mean, Iceland, the Conservative Party comes back. You know, they dumped the Social Democratic Party here recently, and they come back into power on this whole thing about stopping offshore shelters, you know, for their wealthy bankers and investors there in Ireland. I mean, in Iceland. Yeah, well, the prime minister was doing the same as he was saying that. You know, these politicians, you can't believe a thing they say, including U.S. politicians. They'll tell you what they think you need to hear, so you vote for them, and then they'll go and do their business anyway. It's all a big lie. You know, and that includes the Trumps and the Clintons right here. They're lying through their teeth. They're going to do what the big guys want them to do once they're elected. They're going to tell you what they're going to do to make it sound like, you know, they're going to do something for you, but they're lying through their teeth, and they're going to go do what they want anyway. You can't trust a politician of either wings of the corporate party of America. You just cannot trust them for what they say. They think you're stupid. They think you buy, and a lot of people do buy, because, you know, most people think, well, lying's not good, he must not be lying. But they are. Okay, so where does the U.S. elite put their money? Oh, they like the Cayman Islands. Out there in the Caribbean again. Mm-hmm. Also, Switzerland. They put a lot of money in Switzerland. Obama tried to go after him, and then apparently somebody gave him some campaign money, and he backed off. All right. U.S., Switzerland, and Panama, of course. Right. How about the Europeans? How about the Germans? Oh, they love to put their money in Liechtenstein, their little country up there, you know, in Austria, in the mountains there. Oh. Right, Liechtenstein is a favorite place. Also, Luxembourg and Switzerland. That's where the Germans stuff their money, the German elite. Right. A couple of years ago, somehow a laptop got turned in somewhere and had the names of a lot of German investors and wealthy who had stuffed their money in Liechtenstein. There was a flurry for a while and, you know, big deal, a lot of promises, nothing happens. How about the Russians? Oh, they like Cyprus and Switzerland and London, China, Singapore. That's where they stuff their money. By the way, you know, I talked about this Iceland prime minister who had to resign as a result of this Panama Papers revelations that are just beginning. Oh, Mr. Cameron, prime minister of Britain as well. You know, he's scurrying around right now, yesterday, trying to explain why he has money in these offshore shelters when, you know, he promised we're going to stop these offshore shelters in his campaign. You know, he made a lot of promises in his campaign. I like the promise that he made that he was going to put it to a vote whether the UK should stay in the EU. Brexit, they call British exit or not. That vote's coming up in June, you know. He struck a Faustian bargain here with the electorate in the UK. Oh, vote for me and we'll take up this question of exiting Britain and Britain exiting the EU. You know, he thought it would never happen. Oh, well, now it is, and I'm going to make a prediction. I think it's 60-40 that the UK will exit the European Union. And when that happens, whoa, it's going to be instability and uncertainty in the Europe that's already in trouble again. Yeah, I'll talk about it a little later. German, the engine, economic engine of Europe, Germany, slowing down. Okay, and the central bank there, European Central Bank, getting desperate with negative rates and all kinds of, you know, experimental programs trying to stem the inevitable chronic European recession. Chronic. Europe has not recovered since 2009. They had a double dip in 2011-12, and they've been stumbling along ever since. We'll talk about that a little bit more later in the show. We talked about how is that all related to these massive French worker demonstrations going on and protests in France, as France under another so-called social democratic government of François Hollande, trying to engineer labor market reform, as they say. Labor market reform, which is just a euphemism for let's cut some wages some more so we can lower the cost of our exports and get economic growth by exporting into a global economy where trade and everything is shrinking. Oh, let's get a little bigger piece of the pie at the expense of someone else for a little bit of while. You know, that's that whole export-driven strategy that Europe has, the EU and so forth, Germany in particular, has been relying on so much. But as the global economy slows, that's not working. By the way, I have a whole chapter of that in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. That came out this January. There's a chapter on Europe's chronic recovery, chronic recession, you know, and then there's a chapter on Japan's perpetual recession. They've been in recession. They've had five recessions since 2009 in Japan. Both of those countries or regions are basket cases, economic basket cases, and they're getting worse. Anyway, we'll talk a little bit more about other events in Europe here later in the second half of the show. I want to talk about the French worker protests, right? I want to talk about the deal breakdown between the IMF and Greece that was engineered last August, German economic slowdown, Brexit, and maybe Grexit, Greece exit again coming up this summer, and Dutch voters saying, no, we don't want to integrate the Ukraine into our economy. Talk about basket case Ukraine. Oh, Ukraine, as I predicted 2 years ago, would be in depression for several years, and of course it still is. They can't resurrect that. And we've talked about the Ukraine, but, you know, this vote by the Dutch voters, there has to be a total agreement in the EU to absorb someone else, a new country, into the EU. And overwhelmingly, Dutch voters said, no, we don't want Ukraine in the EU because there would be a big welfare basket case that they'd have to pay for. Okay, back to the tax question. We'll talk about more about Europe in the second half. But back to the, you know, the whole tax situation here. Right? We talked about where Europeans like to stuff their money in the Russians and the Chinese and the U.S. and the U.K. Right? How about U.S. corporations? Well, we've been talking about that as well. Again, go to my website, jackrasmus.com, where I've been writing about corporate inversions. And these other loopholes, U.S. corporations putting their money abroad and setting up holding companies and so forth. You know, they even have funny names for it, you know, like the Irish sandwich and the Dutch sandwich and so forth, you know. Legal beagles, and they laugh when they stuff their money away for the rich and everything, and they say, hey, everybody's stupid, you know. But they don't cover it up totally, and once in a while we see a little bit. Inversions have been going on for several years and accelerating now. What's an inversion? That's where a U.S. corporation buys up a little another company in Ireland or Holland or U.K., and where taxes are much less, almost nothing in Ireland, and they set up their headquarters there on paper, and they pay taxes, or virtually no taxes, in Ireland, and instead then they don't have to pay there because now they're a foreign country, a company, right? They do all their business in the U.S., they make all their profits in the U.S., but they simply legally claim, because they're based in Ireland, that they're an Irish company, and they don't have to pay U.S. taxes. You know, all the big tech companies and pharma companies and so forth have been doing this. And they're accumulating huge stashes of cash offshore as a result. And Bloomberg News admits there's at least $2 trillion in Europe, U.S. companies who have stashed their money, their cash abroad. And, you know, they do this very easily because they arrange their internal company bookkeeping so the profits they make in the U.S. get registered in their holding company in Ireland or Holland, and they engage in internal pricing between their subsidiaries offshore and onshore, so that it looks like they're just breaking even. There's no profits in the U.S., but all the profits are recorded in their offshore. So it looks like no profits. They don't have to make anything and pay anything in taxes in the U.S. You know, they talk about the U.S. corporate tax rate, 35%, one of the highest in the world. Oh, that's all BS, because the effective tax rate, what these corporations actually pay, is no more than 12% on average, no more. And what about state taxes, state corporate taxes? What do they pay? 2.2% is what they pay. Okay. So, these corporations are paying less than 15% now. That's why they're not in favor of 15% flat tax, because, they would have to pay more. They like it just the way it is. In fact, we've got in Congress going on another boondoggle dealing with this problem of $2 trillion in offshore. You know, it's costing the U.S. Treasury about $350 billion a year, every year. Repatriation. You know, in 2005, we had the same problem. There was about $1.6 or $7 trillion stuffed offshore. And Congress passed this law that says, oh, well, if you bring it back, you don't have to pay 35%. You pay 5.25%. But if you bring it back and pay 5.25% on that money you've sheltered, U.S. corporation, then you got to invest that money in creating jobs. Well, I followed this in 2005 because I was writing about it in my book, The War at Home. And for about a month, 6 weeks, there was a reporting what companies were bringing what back. But all of a sudden, after 6 weeks, that all froze up. There was no reporting anymore, because the money was being brought back and used not to invest and create jobs, but used to buy up other companies, buy back their stock, and so forth. So they bring, $700-800 billion of the $1.6 trillion at the time in 2005 back. They pay 5.25% on it, tax, instead of 35, and they pocket the rest. And then, of course, they just kept accumulating this money, and now it's back up well over $2 trillion in their offshore subsidiaries. And now Congress is proposing the same thing. They're saying, well, okay, bring it back, repatriate the money, and you pay 10%. No guarantees about job creation, no guarantees of what they're going to do with this money, you know, which is probably going to be, you know, let's increase dividends and buy back our stock once again for the wealthy shareholders in their companies. And the rich are going to get richer. You know, that's just one of the ways they game the system, and the politicians are right at the center of it. And not just U.S. politicians, not just Iceland and Cameron in the U.K., you know, but it's just been revealed, and we're going to see more revelations of these papers, that Mauricio Macri, the new right-wing business billionaire taking over in Argentina and jacking up utility prices and subsidies, cutting subsidies for the people of Argentina now, you know, utility prices going up 3% overnight and 300% rather overnight and so forth, all this going on and squeezing the hell out of the Argentinians while he's paying billions of dollars to hedge funds that the previous government refused to pay, right? So he's paying off the big boys, which means rich Argentinian investors are going to get nice loans now. You know, there's a quid pro quo going on here. And he's squeezing the hell out of average workers in Argentina. Well, he's been keeping his money in offshore shelters, too, it's been revealed. We'll see how that develops in Argentina. This is like the Pentagon Papers of economics here, this Panama Papers. You know, so why did this law firm spill the beans? It's kind of like, you know, economic WikiLeaks here. Why did he spill the beans, this, you know, guy Fonseca, head of the law firm? I think the guy's got to run for political office, high political office. He looked like a big muckraker. right? I don't know. That's just a guess. But there's a story here behind why they revealed this, why this law firm revealed this, spilled the beans. And, you know, it's called the Mossack Fonseca, Mossack Fonseca Law Firm, right, down there in Panama. Oh, there's going to be a lot of fallout from this. And rightfully so. But remember, it's just the tip of the iceberg here. That's all it is. This has been going on for a long time. This is not new, and it's just getting bigger and bigger and worse, you know. So we'll get a little peek into what's going on with this deal here, with the Panama Papers, as they call it, you know. Okay, one more comment here. Tax inversions that we just talked about, been going on, accelerating, and so forth. A lot of pressure was growing on Obama last year to do something about this, because it was, the big pharma companies are the ones who were doing it, and at the same time, these greedy SOB pharmaceutical companies are jacking up prices of drugs in the U.S. by hundreds and thousands of percent over the past couple years. And then they take all this rentier profits. It's called rentier when they suck profits through price manipulation. You know, Turing Pharmaceuticals here. I've been writing about that, this scumbag guy, young hedge fund guy who bought this pharmaceutical company called Turing, and then he starts playing with the pricing of drugs that people need to survive, pregnant women, and cancer patients and so forth. This drug that they had that was being, you know, it was like $15 a pill, and now he raises it to $750 a pill, whatever, and then he spits in the face of congressional investigations and so forth. They ought to throw that guy away for a long time. You know, arrogant SOB. He's just an example of how the pharma company's been jacking up prices. And by the way, what's happening is the financial investors, you know, hedge funds, these kind of vulture guys, have penetrated the pharma industry, because it's so lucrative, speculating and manipulating price, because that's what hedge funds do. That's what financial people, speculators do. They make super capital gains profits by manipulating price. Well, you know, they looked over the fence and they said, oh, the pharmaceutical industry, oh, they got patents. Oh, that's a nice place to manipulate price as well. So they go and buy up these pharma companies, these small pharma companies that have a patent on something, and then they jack the price up. They've all been doing it. Valeant, another Canadian company that got caught doing this, is in deep doo-doo as well. You know, good riddance, Valeant. I hope you go under. But this is the tip of the iceberg. It's an industry problem with pharma speculating on prices. And the point here is that these pharma companies that are doing this are also at the front of the pack here with this tax inversion thing. And the big one this past week, Pfizer attempted to do that with a British partner, Allergan. In other words, buy Allergan and move Pfizer's corporate headquarters to the UK and cut $1 billion in taxes a year. It was estimated Pfizer would save $1 billion a year if it did this. The public outcry was too large, and the Obama administration put some poison pills on the merger mix there, and Pfizer backed off. But that's only one company that the Obama administration attempted to stop, and it was super big, that's why. You know, it would have been $1 billion loss in tax revenue for the government every year. And, you know, the important things about these inversions is it's all on paper to save taxes. I mean, it doesn't mean any change in business and how much is produced and made here or there or whatever. It's all paper manipulation. And it ends up with big tax ripoffs here of the U.S. Treasury. They stopped Pfizer for now. I'm sure Pfizer will wait again till after the elections. And Hillary Clinton, by the way, is getting big money from the pharma companies. You know, they can wait another year. But a lot of the smaller inversions continue going. In other words, what Obama did was just to poison and slow down the Pfizer deal. There's nothing really changed that stops tax inversions in general. And it's going to continue. Okay. Again, if you're interested in my take on this tax question, the great tax ripoff, you want to look at where things were up until 2005, read Chapter 2 of my The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Reagan to Bush, and then a number of updated, extensive articles that I wrote for Z Magazine on my website, Kikos Productions, K-Y-K-O-S Productions.com. They're all there going back, you know, to 2006 and 7, and then most recently writing on tax inversions and so forth for Telesaur, and that's on my blog, jackrasmus.com. All right. Okay. Enough on the tax ripoff. Let's move on. Let's talk about what's going on in Europe. Very interesting. Things are beginning to heat up over there. This past week, we have, to pick up a theme I mentioned earlier, we have this, you know, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of protests in the streets going on against the socialist government, so-called socialist government, by students and workers and so forth, against this pro-business bill called labor market reform. Now, what is labor market reform? Basically, you know, the argument in Europe is that the European governments aren't squeezing their workers as well as the U.S. government. They aren't controlling costs, reducing wage and benefit costs as well. And therefore, they're at a competitive disadvantage against the U.S. when it comes to export sales, right? And therefore, they got to lower their cost of production. Now, they've been doing that through monetary policy, as I've talked about here frequently. And I have two chapters in my book, Systemic Fragility, one just on this phenomenon going on in Europe, and you know, another one on how export-driven growth strategies are doomed. And that's Europe, and that's Germany. Germany growing at the expense of the rest of Europe because it dominates the export internally, exports the scene internally within Europe. And that's because of the way the euro and the euro system in 1999 was set up. My book coming out in a couple months here called Looting Greece, The New Financial Imperialism, explains how after 1999 and the establishment of the euro, Germany was able to dominate, using the euro, internal export-import flows within the eurozone countries, the 17 at the time countries. And that impoverished the southern tier or the periphery, the consequences of which we've been seeing repeatedly here, especially worst case in Greece, right? But it's all because of the way Germany dominated the whole arrangement after the euro was set up. Right? One of the ways Germany did it was repress wage costs back in 2005-06 of its own workers and gave itself this competitive cost advantage within Europe. Right? Well, this whole idea of labor market reform, structural reform of labor markets throughout the rest of the eurozone, is all designed to lower the cost of production by attacking wages and benefits. And therefore, presumably, you got a lower cost of production, you can lower your prices relative to the U.S. and China and whatever else and compete more. It's an export-driven strategy, you see. Lower wage costs. Now, there's another way you can lower costs of exports, and that's by manipulating your currency, the euro. And that's what a lot of this European Central Bank ECB stuff about QE and devaluing the currency is all about. If I can lower the value of my currency, right, that gives me a cost advantage in export competition as well. And they've been doing that. The central bank, ECB, you know, pumping incredible amounts of liquidity into the system with their QE policies and now negative rates and so forth. This all designed, on one hand, is designed to boost the stock markets and the wealthy and the rich and hope that they'll maybe dribble a little bit down in investment, but that's not happening as well. The stock markets, of course, stock and bond markets are a response to not just lowering your currency value. There's a lot of competitive relative factors involved here. So this whole strategy of QE and so forth, driving down the cost, has been designed to make Europe, and especially German exports globally outside the Eurozone, more competitive. And the Germans believe, well, we did it, so, okay, you French and you Italians and you Greeks, you know, you need to do it too. You need to step on your workers and lower their wages. And that's what labor market reform is all about. You see, over the decades since World War II, when European capitalists really need the cooperation of their workers, they developed, a sort of social welfare state, and unions and workers got some rights and some benefits, and one of them was full-time workers that can't just be arbitrarily laid off and fired in Europe, places like France and so forth, and they had good social benefits in those places. But as Europe became less competitive with the U.S. and other areas, they're trying to squeeze their workers. It's called labor market reform. Now, these laws and these benefits applied only to full-time workers in France and elsewhere, Italy. So the way the European capitalists have been getting around this is they just don't hire full-timers anymore. They hire part-timers, part-time jobs, a whole second class of working citizens there. In fact, I believe this is correct data. I read it recently that 90% of all the jobs created in the last couple of years in France have been part-time jobs, 90%. So corporations are getting around the labor laws by not hiring full-time workers. But now they want to attack the full-time workers, too. They want to change these labor laws that would allow them to fire people more easily, allow to have them work overtime without overtime pay, and a whole list of other ways of, quote, reforming. In other words, reform here meaning let the employers squeeze them legally more easily than they have been. That's what labor market reform is, and they've been trying to push it. This was behind a lot of the conflict with Greece last year between the European Union and Greece. Greece was saying, we got to grow our economy, and that means that we've got to put more money in the hands of the workers so that they could spend and consume. And they wanted to go back to where classical social democracy in Europe was in terms of workers' rights and so forth. But the finance elite that was driving this whole thing with Greece said, you can't do that. Well, if they had allowed Greece to do it, it would have stopped in its track this movement to do labor market reform all over Europe. Right? The other example they pointed to was Spain, because Spain, under the business Rajoy, or whatever how you pronounce it, Prime Minister there, did do this labor market reform. It did stimulate Spanish exports. It did, therefore, grow Spain's economy a little bit here in the last couple years. But it didn't raise the incomes of workers at all. In other words, all the benefits of this export increase has gone to Spanish companies or European companies doing business in Spain. We still have the same, almost same level of unemployment and no wage gains in Spain. But it worked for the capitalists, you see. And so now, given the example of Spain, Germany before. Now they're trying to push this labor market reform everywhere in Europe. And the target is France. And they feel, you know, the capitalists over there feel, well, you know, who else could really do this better than a social democratic socialist government like Hollande? They can, you know, they can fool their supporters here in the working class and push it through. You know, kind of sound like what Bill Clinton did with free trade, NAFTA, isn't it? Yeah, of course. And what Obama's done with TPP. Republicans couldn't get this through, but the Democrats can. You know, well, Hollande is, they call it socialist, but he's the, you know, equivalent of the Democratic Party over there. And they're trying to push this thing through. But people are reacting and they're in the streets. And we'll see what happens with this so-called labor market reform. Right? And Italy is watching that real close too, because Italy is a basket case. And at the same time, you know, the elites in Europe are trying to get people to approve bringing in the, you know, the super basket case called Ukraine into the European Union. When Ukraine, when they did the coup over there in 2 years ago, and the first bailout, IMF bailout, $17 billion, I said, oh, you know, that's peanuts. They're going to need at least $50 billion to bail out Ukraine, at least 50. Well, by the end of the year, they had doubled that, and things were getting worse in the Ukraine economically, and they continue to get worse. Ukraine is in the depression, has been for 2 years that I predicted, and $50 billion probably isn't even enough. And now the IMF is balking in the Ukraine. They can see that it's a bottomless pit to bail the Ukraine out. And even though the U.S. and Europe put their two key people in running the Ukraine economy, and, you know, put this Horizon CEO hedge fund person in charge, finance minister in Ukraine, and the Europeans put this guy Abramovicius here, which was related to hedge funds and bankers in Scandinavia and Germany as the economic minister. Well, Abramovicius resigned, and now we got elections going on over there, and you know, our Horizon CEO, which is a private equity firm in the U.S., U.S. citizen, given Ukrainian citizenship overnight, is running for prime minister. Yeah, so, okay, even more direct control. This is all part of this new financial imperialism that we see emerging in Greece and in Ukraine, where exploitation by financial debt is going to be the new model of global colonialism, imperialism, and it's not just what we used to call third world countries out there in Asia and Latin America and Africa. No, it's on the periphery of the capitalist north that they're squeezing as well, taking over the economies of these countries. The EU has taken over Greece's economy. Greece can't make any decision economically on its own anymore. Okay, so I'll be talking about that in my new book, Looting Greece, coming out in a couple of months. That's the situation with Dutch voters who just voted against the Ukraine. Interesting, people are beginning, the masses are beginning to play an increasing role little by little in the European crisis here. French workers, Dutch voters, right? Greece, we see... third-party movements emerging, you know, in Spain, Italy, in France. And what about the German economic slowdown? You know, in my chapter on Europe's chronic contraction in my book, Systemic Fragility, I'm going to post that, by the way, on my website, Kiklos Productions, under articles. So people can see with all this event going on in Germany and in Europe right now, I think it would be interesting. My analysis 6 months ago, I said all this was going to happen, that the export-driven economy with Germany at the engine core there is not going to prove successful, and that the European Central Bank is going to be in this tit-for-tat QE battle with Japan, you know, pumping more and more money into the financial system, into the banking system. You see, the problem with this whole QE and monetary approach to recovery, it's all predicated on putting massive amounts of cash and liquidity in the hands of investors, you know, a huge increase in money supply, and assuming that that's going to be invested, and it's going to be invested in the right place at the right time. That's the false assumption of all this monetary central bank approach at growth, which has been dominating everything since 2009, even in the U.S. They won't spend. There's no fiscal policy. They don't want to do fiscal policy. They don't want to cut taxes for consumers. They don't want a government spending targeting consumers. They don't want to do that because it's not as profitable. It's far more profitable to give the rich investors and bankers the money and hope that they'll dribble some of it down in real investment in the country that creates jobs and recovery that way. Even though it's slower and people don't benefit as much as fast, you know, put the money in our pocket and we'll decide whether to invest it, right? Money supply theory and policy just puts money in the hands of these people, but money demand, in other words, will they invest it, is the key question. And if they do invest it, where will they invest it? You know, where are they investing these trillions and trillions of dollars of central bank injections of liquidity, money, into the hands of the banking system that's been going on since 2008 and 2009. Where has it been invested? Right. Well, a lot of it initially, as I've said before on this show, has been siphoned off to emerging markets for a couple years there. Oh, bigger profits there. So it went offshore. Or they used it to give the money back to their big shareholders. Stock buybacks, dividend payouts, you know, when I wrote about 6 months ago, $5 trillion and rising since 2009, just in the U.S. That's where the money's going. No wonder, you know, they turn around and they don't really invest it in real investment that creates things and jobs. Where do they invest? They invest it in financial assets everywhere globally in the world. The money is either being hoarded on bank and financial institution and corporate balance sheets. They're sitting on trillions, right? Or they're sending it offshore, which they were and they aren't anymore as much. Or they're putting it into financial assets and speculation, stocks and bonds and derivatives, foreign exchange speculation and so forth. Key chapter in my Systemic Fragility book, chapter 11, talks about the shift to financial asset investing instead of real investment. That's a major characteristic of 21st century global capitalism. And the central banks keep pumping money into these folks, and they keep, you know, maneuvering it right back into financial asset markets. Why? Because there's a structure now globally, and a new financial investing elite of about 200,000, whose income flow every year is $10 million or more. That's income flow. That's not asset value, just income from those assets. This is the new mega financial capital elite globally. They have no country. Right? The world is their country. And they've created all these shadow banking institutions that are totally unregulated, you know, private equity firms and hedge funds and boutique banks and all the rest. And more it's all online. Peer lending, crowdfunding, you know, in the book I list all the types of these shadow banks, and I calculate how much capital assets this financial asset, financial investing elite have, and they create all these financial securities in all that they buy and sell in all these liquid markets they've created that these institution shadow banks and so forth use in order to speculate in all of this financial securities, and they just keep creating all these securities, and all the wealth and money just keeps getting concentrated and flowing into this global system of liquid markets, financial asset markets everywhere. And they keep getting richer, richer, richer. You see, and that's why there's global inequality everywhere and why it keeps accelerating. It's not simply that they're squeezing workers. They are, to make their profits. It's because of this financial speculation going on. And it's just running amok. And once in a while, we see a little tip of the iceberg of how much money they got flowing around out there, Panama Papers. See a little bit. But it's huge. It's massive. We're talking about tens of trillions of dollars. The assets of the shadow banks dwarfs the assets now of the commercial regulated banks. Although the commercial regulated banks are in business with them as well. You know, I mean, it's hard to say it's been separated. And, you know, Glass-Steagall never separated this stuff. You know, it just accelerated the shift. When Glass-Steagall was repealed under our buddy there, Clinton, you know, it just accelerated the whole process, and George Bush helped accelerate even more. But it goes back to the 1970s and 80s, when the U.S. led the way to eliminate controls on global money flows. And then we got the Internet, which accelerated the money velocity. And we created this massive overhang of financial structures and speculation. And that's the character of global 21st century financial capital elite. You know, and I debate this with my acquaintances here who claim to be traditional Marxists, you know, who think that everything is being driven by profits of squeezing productive labor. You know, and they point to profits as the key, and the profit rate and so forth. First of all, you can't estimate profits very well globally. And secondly, they're only looking at profits from producing things, not profits from all this financial speculation. Nor do they see the shift of wealth and money going out of real investment and into financial speculation. The problem is capital accumulation. It's not profits. Profits determine only about 20% of investment in capital. Now, when you count financial capital as well as real capital, only 20%. Where does the rest of it come from, all this investment? It comes from debt, and that's why debt is accumulating so rapidly. You know, since 2009, even the Bank of International Settlement says we've had a $50 trillion increase in the level of global debt. I mean, debt was at the core of this collapse in 2008 and 9. And we got 50 trillion more we've piled on in the last 6-7 years. Nothing has changed. It's only gotten worse. And it's just a matter of time before we have another explosion, financial explosion. We can see it. It's coming. And that's one of the topics of my book, but it's based on financial investing analysis as well as real analysis. You know, the Marxists aren't wrong. They're only partly right. They don't see the whole other side of the picture here. And the relationship between finance capital and real asset investing and real capital. It's a relationship between the two that explains the instability going on and why the global economy, real economy, is steadily slowing down and why this financial monster is being built and continues to grow, feeding itself on more and more debt and credit. And mainstream economics has no idea, no explanation for this whatsoever. They're still looking at models based on real production GDP created a half century ago. That's why their models no longer predict. They fail to predict. That's why, based on those models, the IMF and the OECD and the World Bank and so forth, every 6 months they have to revise their forecast of the global economy because it's going down, down, down. As real capital is not being pumped into the real economy anymore to create real jobs, and all you can do is create gig jobs and part-time and contract jobs as a result. Not enough money is going in that side, and the money's being sucked out and going into financial speculation globally everywhere. And this whole network of global liquid financial markets and all the derivatives and securities that have been created on it, that's where it's all going. Capitalism has fundamentally shifted and changed here in the last several decades, and it can't deliver jobs and income for the great majority of the population anymore. There are little pockets here and there in tech and so forth, right? But most of the jobs are part-time, temp jobs, gig jobs, contract jobs. That's the way it's going to be. And I talk about that in Chapter 13 of Systemic Fragility as well. Chapter 12 is about this structural financial shift. 11 is about the shift of investing into financial assets. If you're interested in the book, you can go to my website and my blog, jackrasmus.com. It's on Amazon and so forth. But anyway, you know, chapter 16 is about how mainstream economics has no idea what's going on because they don't understand finance, you see. And then on the financial side, financial experts don't understand the real economy. So you got this bifurcation, and mainstreamers can't get together. They can't put the two pieces together. They don't understand what's going on. And some traditional Marxists are still, you know, reading Volume 1 of Capital 150 years ago. I mean, how could Marx see what all this was going to be? He couldn't, you know, and they're enamored by this falling rate of profit idea, which, you know, I've attacked a number of places. I'm not going to talk about it online here, but it's only a small part of the picture. It's not the whole picture, you see. That's the point. Marx wasn't wrong. He was only half right because he couldn't see everything that was coming. How do you expect someone who wrote something 150 years ago could understand what's going on today? Well, there are some so-called Marxists, you know, in Europe who were challenging this view anyway. Okay, so this is the overview this week, and I'm sure next week will be even more interesting. And we'll talk to you all next week.